So how is our new president doing? All kinds of executive orders. We'll examine it today. We'll look at the prayers at his inauguration and past inaugurations, other contemporary issues. We've got you covered right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are going to build a great border wall.
When you hear those words, do you say, good, do it, we need it, keep the bad ones out, let's get the good ones in? Or do you hear those words and think, oh my God, what are we becoming? What kind of nation are we? This is Michael Brown. Welcome. Welcome to The Line of Fire. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. On the one hand, I'm not keen on executive orders where the president will bypass Congress, will bypass other means of getting things legislated, and will just make a unilateral decision. He has certain liberty to do that. President Barack Obama did it a lot. Each president does it. But I'm pleased with a good number of the executive orders that Donald Trump is writing, maybe all of them. The question is right now, which direction are we going? What about if he is absolutely going to put a freeze on immigration from certain countries until we can strengthen our vetting process, hopefully in a period of weeks? Is that a righteous thing to do to keep out potential terrorists who want to hurt and destroy innocent civilians in our country? Or is that a lack of compassion for others that desperately need a place of refuge in America? Is that place? Is a few weeks or a month that big a difference? Which direction are we heading? We're going to talk about that today on The Line of Fire. Just a couple of small notes along the way. A colleague sent me this article. Transgender activists upset over quote, white cis woman march, cis meaning cisgender, meaning heterosexual. They claim, these transgender activists, these male to females, claim that the women's march was a dangerous space with an oppressive message that having a vagina is essential to womanhood. Yeah. Transgender activists are upset that the women's march over the weekend was not inclusive to biological men who identify as women, as the protest presented an oppressive message that having a vagina is essential to womanhood. Saturday's event to oppose the inauguration of Donald Trump was largely, quote, a white cis woman march with too many pictures of female reproductive organs and pink hats, according to trans women and non-binary individuals interviewed by MIC.com. Yes, a fight is brewing between trans-exclusionary radical feminists, or TERFs, as they're called. I just learned a new term. And trans women, according to the article. How the Women's March genital-based feminism isolated the transgender community. So, you have men who identify as women who are upset with the feminist movement being genital-based. In other words, being a real woman. No, I don't mean being a real woman necessarily in character or attitude, but being a real woman in terms of being a biological chromosomal woman, a female. And notice the pink. I thought that's being sexist to have pink women like pink, boys like blue. Isn't that sexist? Isn't that gender stereotyping? Yeah, it just shows you, once you start opening the door to this kind of chaos, it's just what you are going to get. We come back, I want to talk about some of the executive orders of our president and ask for your feedback. How do you feel about Donald Trump building a wall? How do you feel about a freeze on immigration from certain dangerous countries? 866-348-7884. Phone lines are now open.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I've got to be totally honest with you here, well, as I always am. I don't recall when President Obama came into office the first term, 2009, what he did immediately in terms of how many executive orders he signed, or President George Bush when he came into office the first time 8 years earlier, the same with President Clinton 8 years before that. I don't recall how aggressive they were. I know, for example, that certain pro-life legislation was immediately signed into law or signed back into law by pro-life presidents and then was undone by pro-abortion presidents. I know that. So President Trump signing back into law the Mexico City law that or the Mexico City ordinance that says there'll be no government funding, no U.S. taxpayer money used, no government money used to fund abortion worldwide, and therefore Planned Parenthood being at the top of that list would not be receiving money worldwide. I know that's been done, undone by various administrations. But for sure, Donald Trump is immediately acting on things that he's promised. So if you voted for him and wondered what he was going to do, I mean, he is acting on one thing after another that he promised. Now, for some, that's good news. For others, that's bad news. But, I mean, an executive order stopping TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, that was a signature deal of Barack Obama, and, of course, many conservatives opposed to that, undid that, just froze, just read this, $221 million that just kind of quietly in literally the last hours of President Obama's presidency, John Kerry said, yeah, Secretary of State Kerry said, yeah, we're sending $221 million to the Palestinian Authority. You say, well, aren't there humanitarian needs there? Yeah, they are, because the Palestinian Authority is largely corrupt, and the money does not trickle down to the people. Same with Hamas. It either goes into the pockets of leaders, or it goes for weaponry and large-scale propaganda, anti-Israel propaganda and things like that, weaponry especially with Hamas. And yes, some gets to the people, but the amount of money that's given worldwide, very little gets to the people proportionately. I was talking to some Palestinians years back, and they were Palestinians years back who were anti-Israel as we were talking. But they said, oh, they absolutely despise their own leadership, Palestinian Authority and things like that. They despise that, and they're corrupt, and their children have all the money and go to the best schools, and the Palestinians as a whole are oppressed. So that just was happening quietly, and I just read that President Trump froze that. If it was going to go to actually help people in need, that's one thing, but some of it's going to go actually to aid and abet terrorism. And now, just looking at headlines, wall construction to begin in months, and specific immigration directors with a temporary ban on refugees, particularly from dangerous countries, while the vetting process can be improved. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? 866-348-7884, the number to call. Donald Trump has been accused of being racist, xenophobic, so that would be hyper-nationalist in a dangerous way. And his America First comments could be construed negatively. You could construe his comments to mean we don't care about the rest of the world and we're going to put our own nationalistic interests first no matter what. Or you could say, hey, got to put America first. Every nation has to put itself first, its own interests first, and a strong America is good for the whole world. But again, you're talking about things that people just assume would be empty talk. And he is saying, we're going ahead with this, one thing after another. Says, I believe, February 2nd, so just, what, roughly a week from now, that he's going to nominate the Supreme Court Justice for approval process to replace Antonin Scalia. And so far, the names I'm looking at are names that are on the list, one in particular emerging that seems to be a champion of religious liberties. So we shall see what happens with that. Chuck Schumer has said that they will fight tooth and nail any Supreme Court appointees who are outside of the mainstream. Well, how does he describe mainstream? If Americans voted for Donald Trump to be president, then wouldn't the people on his list, and that's a large reason that many Americans voted for him, was Supreme Court appointees, wouldn't it then be logical to say that those on the list represent the mainstream because this is the man that people voted into office? Or is he going to say that radical leftist judges like Sotomayor and Kagan, both appointed by President Obama, are they mainstream? Yeah, what does that word mean exactly? But from everything I can see so far, President Trump is acting on things that he promised he would act on and would do. Now, I read a report earlier today on an Israel website that Palestinian leaders are claiming that when they spoke with the Trump administration, they indicated that they were not going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. That's contrary to everything I've heard thus far. And Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, who has just been easily approved as the ambassador to the UN, she has reiterated that, yes, we're going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. So these are the radical kinds of things that are talked about but normally not done. And it looks like Donald Trump is acting on these things. Let me also say, if you missed the last half hour of the second hour of the broadcast yesterday, I spoke with James Robison, who participated in a prayer service the morning of the inauguration. And I got online and checked, and it seems to be a common thing. Not all presidents, but the majority of presidents for the last, 50, 60 years plus, that's just as far back as I looked, have gone to a prayer service on the day of the inauguration. So this was a customary thing. But you had folks like James Dobson and Robert Jeffress and James Robison participating in it. So strong evangelical leaders with strong conservative values. And James Robison gave a charge to Donald Trump. You can read it, my message in prayer to the president on stream.org. And asked the president, would he mind standing? He stood up and he addressed him. So he was there with his family, Mike Pence with his family, the entire cabinet. And James has spoken to Donald Trump twice since he's been inaugurated. And President Trump has conveyed his great appreciation to James. And his family, Trump's family, has conveyed to James their great love for him. So it seems that door remains wide open. And one thing that James Robison spoke to Donald Trump about was meekness. Meekness. He spoke about it in the months prior, the 10 months prior to him being elected, and he spoke to him about it the day of his election, meekness, a controlled strength. It is not weakness, but it is a controlled strength, and he urged us to pray that for our president. And you know, to recognize, look, everybody makes mistakes. Think of the disciples shortly before Jesus leaves this earth. Think of the words of Peter and putting his feet in his mouth. And yet, ultimately, he ends up being the lead apostle and being mightily used by God and a writer of part of the New Testament, and one of the men whose names will be on the foundation stones of the New Jerusalem. So I say that to say that James Robison is saying, hey, pray for our president to grow in his role and to stand tall in his role and to carry himself with a meekness that Ronald Reagan exemplified, a strength that is under control. What about the wall? How do you feel when you hear these headlines? Wall construction to begin in months. Does that make you feel good? All right. Needy immigrants, worthy immigrants, immigrants that we can help and that can help our country, by all means, let them in. And other immigrants that shouldn't be here, that do not mean well, that are destructive in their intent, that are lawbreakers, let's keep them out. I'm going to go to the phones momentarily, 866-348-7884, the number to call. When I was in Juarez, Mexico, a few years back, mega church there, maybe 8,000 members, a little bit south of the Texas border, flew into El Paso and did the border crossing into Juarez. I spoke to the pastor there who has served in Mexico at that point over 40 years, but is an American who's ministered and served in Mexico, and his whole family served there for many decades. I asked him how he felt about illegal aliens or undocumented immigrants, however you want to say it. And he was really forceful. He said, do you know how many laws they have to break to do this? You know how, from our perspective, living here in Mexico and seeking to be Christian in Mexico, do you know how many laws they have to break to do it? So, yeah, I believe there needs to be some hope for those who have been here for years and have been integrated in society and raised their kids here, their kids born here. I believe there needs to be some path to citizenship for them. I'd love to see Donald Trump come up with a compassionate and wise solution with the help of those around him. But keeping out those that are coming in illegally and that would do harm to our country, is that what we need? Should we do it? And should we firm up our vetting process for those coming in, even put a freeze on immigration for countries like Syria right now? What do you think? We'll take your calls when we come back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us today on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Donald Trump has been a man of action since he has become president. You may like what he's doing or not, but what you can't deny is that he's doing what he said he was going to do, which is more than a lot of politicians do. You say, yeah, well, I don't like what he's doing. Hey, that's your opinion. You're entitled to feel that way. But he's acting on a lot of his promises. One of the big concerns I had early on was that he was going to flip-flop, that you didn't know where he really stood, what he really believed, what his values were, what his viewpoints were, what he was just saying to be elected. But it seems there are things that are part of who he is now that he holds to. And that's surprise to surprise. He's acting on things that are important to many conservative Christians in America. But the immigration issue is one of those debatable questions in terms of compassion and justice and righteousness. How do those flow together? 866-34-TRUTH. Visit thelineoffire.org, thelineoffire.org. We've got brand new videos on the digital library, a bunch of them. When Muslim women accuse Trump of misogyny, brand new, just recorded yesterday. Who are the Nephilim? Genesis 6. What else? Is Sharia law about personal relationship with God? And do Jews need Jesus to be saved? Do Jews need to be saved? That is, these are all new videos on our digital library, free for you to watch. 866-348-7884. Let's start in Springfield, Virginia with Buck. Welcome, sir, to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown.
Hey.
I've been around the RNC for some time. I was a assistant to the chairman, Haley Barber, and that's a long time ago. Naval architect. I've been telling them I got the money to pay for their wall, and I've been telling them since June, and they understand what I'm doing. I've been emailing them all the time when I get these questions, and I'll share it with you, okay? Mr. El Chapo, you can see his arrest on to Google it. It's El Chapo. Home and money, and you can see the money El Chapo has got there. It's $22 billion. I said with a B, billion.
So you're saying this is all drug cartel money that he has?
Yeah. He's in New York. We're going to get his money. Half of that money will pay for that wall. The other half can pay for that. You know, I'm not going to tell him what to do with the money, but it seemed like he would speak up. He would say, oh, thank you, Mr. Burrow, or something, and because that's what they do to me down at RNC. I worked there a long time ago.
All right, so you feel, though, that we need to have a wall, that it's important to keep folks out that shouldn't be here, and that it's not going to stop those that are worthy immigrants from coming in?
Oh, people will come in by airplane, and then they'll just overstay their They will fly in.
What's the purpose of the wall then, in your view?
Keep people out.
All right, so you're going to keep more people out. Okay, got it. I appreciate it, and you've solved the problem of how to pay for it. Thanks, Buck. I appreciate it. 866-348-7884. Yeah, there is a humanitarian crisis, especially countries like Syria, countries that have been torn by Islamic civil war. There is a humanitarian crisis. One obvious question, though, and I've raised this, I'm not the only one, many have raised this, what about the rich Arab nations, the rich Muslim nations? What about Saudi Arabia? What about Dubai? What about United Arab Emirates? What about Qatar and these other countries that are wealthy, that are in all types of massive building programs? At one time, I read that the majority of cranes being used in a good part of the world were all in Dubai, building these skyscrapers and all types of new buildings, facilities going up with the oil money that has made some of these relatively young countries extremely, extremely wealthy. Okay, they share the same religion. The vast majority of refugees from Syria are Muslim just because of the population. Very few Christian refugees being taken in America or anywhere for that matter, and there are a number of reasons for it, but that's a horror. But you've got primarily Muslim refugees, right? So you share the same religion, Islam. You share the same culture, Middle East versus Europe or versus Australia or somewhere else, right? And you have a common language, Arabic. You have dialectical differences, but it's the same language. Just like you have dialectical differences between Southern English or English in Louisiana versus English in Boston, the dialectical differences. But Arabic, common language. So you got a common culture, common language, common religion. Wouldn't it be ideal for the refugees to be absorbed by their own Muslim, Arabic-speaking Middle Eastern brethren? Why is so little actually done in that regard? Instead, you have refugees flooding into other countries, flooding into Europe. You have a language difference, you have a cultural difference, you have a religious difference. And in many cases, there's not a desire on the part of the refugees to assimilate. So, bottom line, very, very simple. It makes sense to me to make sure that we are doing our vetting properly, even if it means putting a temporary halt on refugees coming in from several countries, but temporary. In other words, take a few weeks, re-examine the vetting process, make sure that things are being done properly, look at errors that have been made, work with other countries that where there's a holding place for refugees and things like that, so that we can make sure that we have a smooth process of those that are in legitimate need and are not coming here radicalized or to undermine our country, that they have a way in, whereas those that have ulterior motives or want to undermine our culture and our country, those are the ones that are kept out. We have no obligation to take in everyone in need around the world, especially if they want to undermine who we are. But we are a country that has been made up of refugees through the centuries and have made us part of the nation that we are, as long as we can maintain our national identity in the process. 866-34-TRUTH, always the number to call. Hey, you start off the new year, you want to make radical changes. How do you keep them? How do you live in victory over sin? How do you live in purity? How are you strengthened to live these resolutions out? We've got a special resource package I think will really help you to start this new year. Check it out at thelineoffire.org. Thelineoffire.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the line of fire, Michael Brown. So glad to spend this time together with you. 866-348-7884. I'm bringing on a special guest, a co-contributor to the stream, stream.org, where I write several articles a week, James Robison's website. He's the publisher of the stream. And I'm going to bring on another contributor to join me momentarily. But first, I want to grab a couple more calls from you about immigration and how you feel about the steps that President Trump is actually taking. We go to Linda in Brooklyn. Hey, Linda, welcome to the line of fire.
Thank you. I have a few words to say. Yes, I did. I voted for Trump. I'm in agreement with the wall. That's one thing. But what should work with that is to overhaul the immigration system itself, which includes the visa overstaying and updating requirements for employers, because it works in their best interest when they can hire someone less than minimum wage. But how they report, how they hire immigrants, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. In point of fact, there are people who will pay under the table and do different things so that they can save themselves money, save tax money, and pay someone who's here illegally, pay them illegally. And obviously, there has to be a better crackdown of that. But, you know, one big thing, Linda, is this whole sanctuary city idea. You know, when you've got mayors and things like that saying, we don't care what Donald Trump does, we're going to have a sanctuary city. That's when it gets a little scary to me. I mean, if they are violating the law, I'm all for compassion. And again, I hope that President Trump and his team will come up with a way for those that have been here working in our country for years, raising families here, not lawbreakers, contributing to the country, but maybe they came in illegally. There should be penalties and things like that. But some path for them. I hope that's the case. But when you have a sanctuary city, when you have people that shouldn't be here being protected, and then they say they're going to defy the president, that's scary to me.
Yeah, that's California. That's, I don't want to, well, yes, you're right on that. And the thing of it is that then it becomes an issue. I think the issue back then was federal funding, in other words.
So you basically cut that off. Right, you basically cut that off, Linda. And say, hey, you're not going to get that. You're not going to get that funding if you're going to violate our national policies. And by the way, it's all over the country. Not California may be most noted for it, but sanctuary cities all over the country. Hey, Linda, I got to run, but thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Let's go to JP in Springfield, Maryland. Your take.
That's Springdale, Maryland.
Springdale, my bad.
In any case, I did not vote for Trump. I voted for Hillary reluctantly because I was choosing between the known devil and the suspected witch. But in any case, I have very serious reservations about the immigration policy. One of the things is I was watching a clip about this man. I think he was from an Eastern country. He was a correspondent. He was interviewing a white man here in the United States, and I don't know what the man's name was, but the white man was talking about how the United States was built by white people, so white people's country. He doesn't want to become white people become a minority, and the man asked, you know, a number of questions about whether this was in the democratic process and so forth and so on. In any case, the same correspondent was at a Trump...
Hey, sir, I apologize. I've got a break, and then I've got a guest coming on. But you're concerned that this is just about, hey, we got to keep America white. We got to keep America Caucasian. We got to keep others out. We got to stay in the majority. That's the sentiment. I understand the concern. Got to run.
God of light, hear our cry.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I mentioned earlier in the hour that there are now transgender women, so men who identify as women, who were upset with the Women's March over the weekend, not because of some of the rhetoric or some of the hateful comments that were made, but rather because of all the pink colors and depictions of reproductive organs, and you're making biology what determines who is a woman. And, of course, the battle now rages between those who say, well, we're women, even though we're biological men, we're women, and other women saying, no, we're women because we're born women. And anyway, who expected this latest development? My guest, Jennifer Hartline, senior contributor to the stream, a proud Army wife, mother of four children. She's published extensively at Catholic Online and Catholic Stand. Her most recent article on the stream, where I write regularly, stream.org, is Nasty Women Writing a Horrifying History of Our Times. Jennifer, welcome to the Line of Fire. Great to have you on with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jennifer, as a woman, as a mother of four, how do you feel about the Women's March and some of the female rage against Donald Trump? Can you understand it? Do you think it's merited? Do you think it's part of a larger misplaced feminism?
Well, I can say for starters that Women's March certainly didn't represent me. And we already know that women like me weren't really welcome there in the first place. Women with a conservative viewpoint, women with a pro-life viewpoint, a traditional marriage viewpoint. That's not what this march was about, and they didn't want those views represented there. They called it a women's march, but if you stop and look at what they were supposedly protesting, which was pretty scattered, there really wasn't a very focused theme, except that the theme was, we hate Donald Trump, we hate Republicans, they're going to take away our abortions and our birth control, and so everybody hates us. That seems to be the theme. And is it misplaced feminism? It's not really feminism at all, in my opinion, because anything that is inherently as unfeminine and as unwomanly as that was, as all of that sentiment is, as all of that anger, as all of that rejection of the gift of femininity, you can't call that feminism. It's just we're angry at men, we're angry at our own biology, we're angry at this and angry at that, and just yuck.
Yeah, that would be a good summary, just yuck. I think sums things up. How would you then describe feminism and femininity? What does that mean to you from a biblical viewpoint, a family viewpoint, a social viewpoint? If someone said, or some young lady you're talking to at college or something like that, and she wants to know, okay, what is feminine? What does it mean to be a woman? How would you answer that?
You know, you see all kinds of... It's like we live today on memes, right? Especially on social media, there's memes for this and memes for that, and all these great little people try to take a great philosophy and sum it up in one or two sentences, and a lot of times that's a big failure. But every now and then somebody gets one right. And one that I've seen in the last week a lot that really rings true for me is this. Women are not supposed to be able to do everything a man can do. We weren't created to do all the same things and everything that a man can do. Women were created to do all the things a man can't do.
Mm.
And I think what that means to me is appreciate the gift of your femininity. Your female body and your female nature was designed by a very thoughtful and a very intentional and a very purposeful God for a very specific reason. And you have a very specific contribution to make to humanity, to the human person, and especially to the human family and the domestic family. And we have a power within the human body to cooperate with God in creating new life. Now, obviously, we need men to do that, but it's the human, it's the female body that God chose to accomplish that miracle. And yes, there's much more to being a woman than that. I'm not trying to simply zero in on that and say that's the source and summit of being female, but it is a large, I mean, it's the beauty of being female is having the biological ability to cooperate with God and making new life. That there's so much power in that. But the feminine nature as well, it's not supposed to be some backwards imitation of a man's nature. It is supposed to be complementary to masculinity, and we need authentic masculinity, and we need authentic femininity. The two are different. They're not supposed to be the same. And by trying to make them, equal in every way, you lose the beauty of both of them. You lose the distinctive qualities of both of them. So I guess what I would want to say to young women today is stop wasting your energy and your time trying to prove you can be just like a man. God didn't make you a man. He made you a woman. He made you female, and there's glory in that. There's beauty in that. There's power in that, and you don't have to go stealing power from masculinity for yourself. You've already got it there in your femininity.
So would you say then, aside from sometimes a hatred of men, maybe a woman who was taken advantage of by a man or hurt by a man or raped or things like that, you can understand the reaction, the emotional reaction.
Yes, certainly.
But is there something larger than just some of the radical feminist hatred of males? Is there also an insecurity of womanhood in many of these women from your observation?
Well, yes, I'm sure there is. And I think, a big part of the problem is that we're witnessing that motherhood is being denigrated and the role of the unique role that only a woman can play as a mother in a family. We've had decades of feminism telling us that that's not good enough. That's not good enough. You're supposed to do more than that. You're supposed to want to do more than that. And if you don't, then there's something wrong with you now. There is this. I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought there. So
yeah, there is a certain insecurity of womanhood in that regard, and saying, hey, I can embrace the uniqueness of how God made me. And again, it's not simply, they'd mock it with just a baby manufacturing machine, but you're looking at the larger issues, the creative gift, the reproductive gift, the nurturing gift, the complementary gift to the man, that there's a thriving in that. And it has nothing to do with lack of strength. When I think courageous people, the most, in many cases, the most courageous people I know are women and mothers, and the people of the most unshakable character and backbone and things like that, and least willing to compromise are women. My wife Nancy has the strongest backbone of any human being I know in the world, literally. But at the same time, she wants me to be the head of the house, and she wants me to have a setting where she feels protected and covered because I'm doing my job. And it's a matter of function. It's a matter of calling. It's a matter of identity. And you almost get the feeling that if there are a bunch, I don't know the demographics of the march, but you can almost imagine if there are a bunch of pregnant women marching at this women's protest over the weekend, that many of them not felt particularly welcome.
No, I can easily imagine that they would have felt a little out of place, a little odd there in that setting. And getting back to what you were saying earlier, it's also about each of us, about men and women being and doing and living the vocation that God has given us as men and women. And again, it's not supposed to be the same, but what they are complementary. There's nothing more glorious in God's creation than what happens when a man and a woman come together as they're supposed to and complement each other with their mutual strengths and their mutual gifts. And wow, that's a force of nature that nobody can reckon with. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be. So it's about that appropriate balance. Masculinity,
absolutely.
And femininity.
All right, stay right there, Jennifer. I want to talk to you about your latest article. What's the title? It's catchy. Nasty Women, Writing a Horrifying History of Our Times. You can read it at stream.org. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. If you'd like to interact with my guest, Jennifer Hartline, she is a senior contributor to The Stream, published by James Robison. I write there frequently as well. And her latest article, Nasty Women, Writing a Horrifying History of Our Times. Jennifer, what's that article about? Why do you call them nasty women? And what's the horrifying history that they're writing?
Well, I'm not calling them nasty women. They're calling themselves nasty women. And that is the point. They've taken up this new label, seeing it as some sort of a compliment or some sort of empowering term in some bizarre way. And it goes back to, it's a reference to when Donald Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman during the campaign. But now they've taken up this label, this term of nasty, and there were signs all over the place, various signs during this march that we saw pictures of, stay nasty and I'm a nasty woman and other variations on the theme. And yeah, I was just writing about how truly tragic and sad that is, that these women are answering, they're taking their offense at what Donald Trump said and his behavior and some of his words toward women in the past, and they're just using the exact same language and the exact same degrading terms and the same vulgar sexual terms and using it for themselves, talking about themselves in that way, talking about their female anatomy in a word that I'm not going to say. And I really hope we stop seeing that word real soon. And they're just, this is how they're speaking. This is how they're talking about themselves. They're doing this in front of their children. Some of the photos that came out of that march were really heartbreaking of the women and even fathers who brought their very young children with them. And some of the signs that they were holding with their young children, it just broke my heart. It was just so vulgar. There was so much profanity, so much vulgarity, so much crassness coming out of that march, coming out of the speakers from Madonna to Ashley Judd and some of the other celebrities and famous speakers. Everything was so crass. And again, there is nothing feminine about being crass. There's nothing to be proud of about being vulgar and profane, and there certainly isn't any sort of demented woman power in it, and that's how it's being presented. And again, the title of the article refers to the wisdom of the now venerable Archbishop Fulton Sheen when he said, and I quoted him in my piece, he said, I'm paraphrasing now, but the history of any civilization is basically written by the women. And it's written in terms of the level of womanhood. And the virtue of a woman, the higher her virtue, the higher her morality, then the more a man has to aspire to be worthy of her. And his point is that the virtue of women has the effect of causing men to jump higher to that standard in order to meet her there. So it raises the level of virtue of the men in society as well. And, of course, the reverse is also true.
Right.
And that was another point that I was making in the piece. You know, nasty women, as they're calling themselves, well, they treat men, they teach men to treat them that way.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, it's not going to raise the standard, raise the calling on men to step higher. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Frank Turek, one of his books pointed out that you don't normally see a married man in a gang. There is a tempering effect that the woman will have on the man in the relationship, and that can be the same in a societal way. Hey, let me get you to interact with a caller who's got a little different perspective. Alicia in San Clemente, California, welcome to the Line of Fire. Time is short, so why don't you dive right in with your thought and let Jennifer respond.
Hi, Dr. Brown. It's an honor to be on your show. I self-identify as a Christian feminist. However, I am not angry. I have no agenda against men, and I would not have marched in the march because I felt like there were too many other political agendas mixed in with that, and I had no desire to march against Trump, per se.
Mm-hmm.
But Jennifer, my challenge to you is that I feel like perhaps you're oversimplifying the categories, because there are Christian feminists who love Jesus, who simply desire for men and women to be treated equally in society and in the workplace as they were in the garden before the fall. And when you primarily focus on a woman's gifting having to do with mothering and nurturing and bearing children, quite honestly, it's a slap in the face to those who desired that and ended up infertile, ended up single, and perhaps God has given them other gifts and callings to be in full-time ministry or in the marketplace or in the career. And it sort of feels like that is a lesser calling or a somehow a not full expression of their femininity. Now, I'm a mother. I've been infertile. I'm believing God can give us kids, but he's given us a beautiful son to adopt. I'm feeding him lunch right now. I'm also in ministry. I teach and preach the word. I love mentoring young people. So I kind of have my feet in a lot of areas, but I've experienced in talking with people quite a bit of pain on behalf of especially Christian women that hear the feminist categories really oversimplified like that, because it feels like their voices are unheard and unvalued.
Alicia, thank you for being so eloquent and clear on that. Your response to Alicia.
Well, I hear her and I understand what she's saying. And so I will say up front, I don't mean to insult women who identify as Christian feminists at all. I don't mean to be insulting toward them. And I do recognize that there are women who have vocations in addition to being wives, mothers. They work outside the home. They have brilliant careers. I understand all of that, and I have no objection to that. Nothing wrong with that by any stretch of the imagination. So if I seemed focused on one thing in particular, let me try and maybe explain why. And it's because I think in our society, in our culture right now, that particular aspect of being a woman is under terrible assault, terrible, terrible assault. And the fact that we live in an age that is defined, we are absolutely defined right now by our zealous demand for the so-called right to kill our own children. That's unusual in human history. I'm not saying that abortion is a modern phenomenon. It's certainly not. People have found all sorts of horrifying, wretched ways to get rid of unwanted children all throughout human history. But in our time, it's legal. It's protected
and it's
by
celebrated.
Law.
Hey, I've just got to jump in. This is a great discussion, but we're out of time. Alicia, your call is important. Jennifer, thank you so much for what you've shared. And yes, being a mother is under severe attack. We need to celebrate that again and celebrate the overall calling on women. Thank you, dear sisters, for being with us. So how is our new president doing? All kinds of executive orders. We'll examine it today. We'll look at the prayers at his inauguration and past inaugurations, other contemporary issues. We've got you covered right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I don't think it's a strategy. This is a character problem. He defines himself as a winner. Good people are winners. He's always said that.
But frankly, he is a winner.
And he is winner.
He turns out to win.
He does. But look, he's obsessed with the fact that he won the election and nobody cares about the popular vote. He does. So he considers this a slight to his image and to his self-image as a guy who runs the table, who wins everything. Why did he bring up the size of the crowd at the inaugural? That's nuts. Nobody cares. He cares. Why did he bring up the ratings for The Apprentice? He cares about this. And you go back to the Iowa primary, he had to blame his coming second on a trick done by Ted Cruz, Lion Ted. That's his character. He wins anyway. So maybe in the end it won't matter, but that's the answer. It's a character issue.
That's the voice, of course, of Charles Krauthammer talking about our president, and his observations may well be true, but the bigger issue is this. Donald Trump is doing what he said he would do if elected. He is acting on the things that he said would be part of his platform, from wanting to cut down the size of the federal government and immediately putting a freeze on hiring federal employees outside of the military, immediately now acting on some of the immigration issues he said he would and saying, yeah, we're going to build that wall, immediately signing back into law the Mexico City policy that bans funding of NGOs, non-governmental organizations worldwide. American money cannot be used for abortions. That hits Planned Parenthood more than anybody. He's doing a lot of the things he said that he would do. And yeah, he's still Donald Trump, and he still has these personality quirks and issues and things that you could say are really detrimental to him being president. But hopefully he'll continue to grow into the office of the president, and with good people around him could get a lot of good done. So pray for our president. And speaking of prayer, I went back and looked at all of the inaugurations. Oh, how far back? Maybe back to Eisenhower or so. And Donald Trump had probably more people praying at his inauguration than anybody before. Maybe one or two were close, and the vast bulk of them, aside from a rabbi, well-known rabbi, the vast bulk of them were conservative Christians, and most of the prayers were prayed in Jesus' name. Now, you can contrast that with the prayer that was given by Reverend Luis León at President Obama's 2013 inauguration, and he is Episcopalian. He included a reference to all Americans, be they gay or straight, in his prayer, so that would be the first of its kind. And while there are many good things that he asked for, there was no in Jesus' name invocation like that in any way that would have been considered too specific and too exclusionary. So that just gives you an idea of the type of clergy that each of these leaders would be comfortable with or exposed to. Yes, there were evangelicals who had access to Barack Obama as well, but some of them leaning more to the left, and none of them that I can tell having the influence that the evangelicals around him are having now. So, hey, with all of Donald Trump's weaknesses and obvious warts in that respect, the man said, I want prayer, I want prayer, I want prayer. So let's pray. We come back. Let's think forward. Not just learning from mistakes. Let's think forward.
Fire we want, for fire we need.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So when I was in Singapore, I was asked to prepare a lecture on PowerPoint that would be distributed to youth pastors and leaders all through Asia, addressing LGBT activism, how to respond, and how the church should be conducting itself in this hour. And at the end of the presentation, I gave a warning from America, five lessons to learn from mistakes we made in America. Those five lessons come from the preface to my book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, that's coming out in Korean. So I wrote a special preface for the Korean edition at their request. But one of the issues is we tend to be very reactionary. We see something wrong in the society and we react against it. And we know Christian principles to seek to love the Lord, love our neighbor, and have godly marriages and raise godly families and things like that. But we are very seldom proactive. We tend to be reactive when it comes to moral and cultural issues. Surely that's not a winning strategy. I want to speak now with Erin Brownback. She is working on a PhD in social transformation. I've got to explore that with her. She directed communications for the Sanctity of Life legal work of the Alliance Defending Freedom, and she's an advocate for the goodness of God's design for the family as the ideal foundation society. Erin, it's great to have you on the Line of Fire. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Dr. Brown. It's great to be here.
Well, Erin, before we get into some specifics, what in the world is a PhD in social transformation, and where are you earning it?
So I am slowly working my way, as I also work full-time, through the coursework for a PhD in social transformation, looking at four major social movements that have been successful and what we can learn from them to apply to what I call the pro-family movement. So I look at the gender, marriage, sex, life, and parenting deconstruction that has happened in our country and what we can do to rebuild the family as the ideal foundation for society. I've been studying at Arizona State University in this coursework, and like I said, just slowly moving my way through it.
And what's the mentality of the professors, the main professors in this department, as far as their worldview?
So it hasn't been welcoming of the same views that I have. I've certainly had textbooks that have said things like Republicans are old, white, increasingly male, paranoid, racist. So it's not the same position that I take, but I've learned that I can learn in any environment, and some of the best environments for me to learn in are from people who have disagreeing opinions. Those are the people who I want to influence. So why not learn from them and with them?
Yeah, all of my college and grad work, my bachelor's, master's, and PhD were all in secular universities. I did not study with a single professor that agreed with me on the Bible or some of my spiritual views. But one thing was, many of them were brilliant and learned. I learned from them. And the other thing is, it's a great challenge to your own views to really sort these things through. It's easy to put forth your views when everybody agrees with you. It's great to really have them challenged. So when they think of cultural transformation, Erin, is there a particular model that they look at? You know, are they looking at a certain Marxist model or some other model for cultural transformation? Or is it just random depending on who's teaching and lecturing?
You know, I've been really fascinated by how often we talk about deconstruction and sort of deconstruction as an ideal. That's a very common thread. Another common thread that I found in almost everything that I've read and most of the classes has been a bent toward Marxism and the idea that Marxism has not been fully explored and has benefits that we haven't yet seen. So those are some of the common themes that I've learned in my time.
I mean, it's so fascinating with virtually the universal failure of Marxism wherever it's been implemented that maybe you get a little further away from some of the collapse of it and you think, well, it really would work if we did it right. But I have a book coming out in September called Saving a Sick America, and one of their chapters is on having a multi-generational mentality as the key to rebuilding American families. And in that chapter, I quote from Carl Zimmerman, a famous anthropologist or sociologist at Harvard, his most famous book, Family and Civilization. And of course, for him, everything has to do with the strength of the family. And he's just looking at it, again, as a Harvard sociologist, as opposed to a Bible believer. On a sociological level, on an anthropological level, when you look at history, when you look at society, how true is it that the strength of the family is the strength of the nation, and that the family really is the building block for civilization?
Absolutely. I mean, it is just as you're describing. We know that as the family goes, so goes society. The family is the ultimate party affiliation. And once we break that down and deconstruct that, as we've really seen happen since the time of the sexual revolution in America, the nation follows. The deconstruction of the nation and the breakdown of the nation follows. And we've seen that in Babylon and Rome and Greece and some other places. And, you know, one of the patterns in the decline of some of these great nations and empires that have come before us is that there has been a sexual revolution that has led to a rise in feminism, which I know when I learned about that, I was surprised. I thought feminism, you know, was something new to America, but it turns out there really is nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, it's true.
And that rise in feminism leads, understandably, to the emasculation of men, because the feminism that I'm talking about isn't a feminism that says men and women are both valuable and both bring gifts to the table. It's the kind of feminism that says men and women are the same and interchangeable. And that then produces a rise in homosexuality, there's a corresponding, what they found in history is a corresponding rise in child, child welfare laws, showing that children are not in homes with mothers and fathers, not seeing the family as the foundation of their own life. And then the ultimate outcome of all of that is a weakening of the military, because when men are weak in society, the military is weak. And, you know, we've seen that going on in our own country as they've been working to draft women over this last year, that there's a rise in power from the outside that's seeking to tear the nation down, and the military is weak, and if they don't do something, we'll be in trouble. So America is on the same path family-wise and you know, structural integrity-wise as some great nations that have come before us. But I do believe there is hope, and that's why I've been working on a long-term messaging plan for how to rebuild the family as the ideal foundation of society.
What about the deconstruction of gender? Where does that fit in?
So when I said that the rise in feminism that says men and women are the same and interchangeable, that's where that comes from. And frankly, the deconstruction of gender comes out of the sexual revolution. And, you know, Dr. Brown, we really need to look at ourselves and say, look, the sexual revolution didn't start with the promotion of homosexuality or the promotion of transsexuality. It really started with the promotion of promiscuity. Mm-hmm. And then that also led into no-fault divorce. And, you know, many people have sort of bought into that as acceptable, either acceptable behavior in our own lives or acceptable entertainment on television, in movies, and things like that. When we have that kind of attitude that sex is something that is just meant for my indulgence and my pleasure, the natural outcropping of that is for it to lead into, well, therefore I can, you know, have you know, same-sex relations, or, you know, interact with animals in this way, or all the different, you know, I don't know, you may be aware of this, but the American Psychological Association recently declassified pedophilia as a disorder and mm-hmm. reclassified it as an orientation. So they're saying, using the same arguments that were used for same-sex relationships.
Yeah, in my book, A Queer Thing Happened to America, which came out in 2011, I have a very disturbing chapter where I list either 7 or 8 major arguments in favor of homosexuality and gay activism, and show how every one of them, without exception, has been used very powerfully by the so-called man-boy love movement. You know, I was born this way, and it's diverse in nature, and it's actually positive, and so on and so forth. But if we trace things back, if we think back to 1960, that's when the birth control pill is now introduced somewhat quietly, and you detach sex from procreation and attach sex to recreation. And then, of course, it's not related to marriage. It's not in marriage. It's not related to children, childbearing, family. And you can see how these things spiral. So what do we do about this? That's what we'll talk about with Aaron Brownback when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I just pulled this up, a summary from Family and Civilization, the magnum opus of Harvard sociologist and historian Carl Zimmerman. He outlined 8 significant indicators of cultural decline. Marriage lost its sacredness, was frequently broken by divorce. That's 1. Traditional meaning of the marriage ceremony was lost. That's 2. 3. Feminist movements appeared. Women lost interest in childbearing and mothering. 4. Public disrespect for parents and authority in general increased. 5. Juvenile delinquency, promiscuity, and rebellion accelerated. 6. People with traditional marriages refused to accept family responsibilities. 7. Desire for and acceptance of adultery grew. 8. Increased tolerance for sexual perversion of all kinds, particularly homosexuality, with a resultant increase in sex-related crimes. This is what Carl Zimmerman wrote in the 40s, talking about what had happened in previous societies. Pretty striking. So, Aaron, speaking with Aaron Brownback, this is exactly what you just described as you've been working on your PhD in cultural transformation. So what's happening in America, in that respect, is nothing new. We've seen this happen in societies in the past. What happens to those societies?
So those societies, as they break down from within, one of the things I mentioned earlier was that they often have a weak facing military. And so they're weak from within, and then they're also weak from without. And as there are rising powers outside that seek to destroy, they collapse from those attacks. So if we look at the rise in Islamic terrorism that's come against America, you know, we've had more attack going on in recent years than we've had for some time. And we've just are positioned weakly if our foundation of our society is not strong.
All right. So it's really extraordinary that you have to have a bird's eye view of things to see what happens when the family gets broken down. We see it, for example, in the African-American community, that in the early days of the civil rights movement, the families were much more intact. The kids were growing up with two-parent households. Crime rates were lower. And then with policies that were instituted, whether intentionally or not, that ended up undermining the family and almost penalizing a woman for being married as she was raising her kids, you end up with a crisis today, and it goes back to the breakdown of the family. When no-fault divorce was implemented, hey, this is in the kids' best interest, they shouldn't be around the parents fighting and seeing the conflict, then you see 25 years later and onwards the destructive impact on it. So that's the problem, isn't it, Aaron, that things don't necessarily happen in a twinkle of an eye, but when you step back and look, it's undeniable to see the regress, the destruction of society that happens when the family unit is attacked.
Absolutely. So like you said, in the early days of the civil rights movement, more black children were born into two-parent households than white children were, which is astounding when you look at the numbers now. And really, the sort of fulcrum for the change when that started taking place was when welfare laws, which were created to aid war widows in World War I, the country said, we owe a debt to you. Society owes a debt to you. You've lost your husband on our behalf, and our society would be better off if there were at least the mother in the home rather than both parents gone, the mother out working and the father having died in the war. So that's where welfare started. Well, then it was transitioned to be something that was provided for illegitimate children. And when that happened, that was sort of the turning point for the real deconstruction of the Black family. So there's a lot of well-meaning laws. President Reagan, when he was governor, was the one who enacted no-fault divorce.
Yep.
A lot of well-intentioned people who have not looked far enough down the road at what the results might end up being on society.
All right, so here we are facing a real problem in America with so many people living together out of wedlock, having kids out of wedlock, getting married, and if things don't work out, a few months later, a year later, they divorce and go on. It's pervasive in the media. The same media that in years past celebrated homosexuality is now celebrating polyamory and polygamy. There's even celebration of consensual adult incest in Hollywood and TV and things like that. Is it possible to rebuild a society that has fallen as far as it has? We can add in abortion as another aspect of the breakdown of the family and the loss of sanctity of life. Is there a way back?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I will say two things. One, if we do it, we will be the first great nation that I'm aware of to ever accomplish that. On the other hand, though, I'm hopeful, and here's why. This has happened more quickly in America than has ever happened before that I'm aware of in the world. And the reason for that is our mass communication system.
Mm-hmm.
So bad ideas spread faster. But because of that, we still have people in positions of leadership who remember, who know what healthy and stable families look like in the society that they create, who are willing to stand up and move toward that and move our nation toward that. So a lot of people tend to think this just happens of its own accord. This is just grassroots. It was bound to happen that, same-sex relationships would become acceptable in society. That's advanced thinking. But what they don't recognize, because we don't have that bird's eye view all the time, is that there are strategic messaging plans put into place to change public perception around issues. One of the very well-known ones that you know of course, is the overhauling of Straight America, which was yep. turned into After the Ball. You can go on to my website at aaronbrownback.com and see a copy of it there. And what we haven't done as conservatives and as Christians is put a messaging plan into place for how we will establish the goodness of God's design for the family as this foundation of society. And we haven't done that because we didn't need to. For 200 years, it was very easy to be an American and a Christian because our values were so aligned. But now as those diverge, it's very important for us to look down the road at 20 to 30 years from now, ask where we want to be, and then get the messaging out into the culture that will help to move us that direction.
All right, so this issue of messaging, I want to take up with you on the other side of the break. The other thing that's positive, Aaron, about things collapsing so quickly is that when they happen that quickly, it's very easy for those with a different ideology to overplay their hand. It goes so quickly. Mm. If it's over a period of generations, you lose sight of it. You lose track of it. What's it like for someone being raised in North Korea today as opposed to 50 years ago? So I'm not comparing gay activists to North Korea, but simply the fact that when things happen this quickly, we're seeing a pushback now with some aspects of transgender activism and perception becoming reality that we didn't see in terms of some of the pushback against gay activism. So by all means, there is hope. We can bring about change for the good of the nation. But how can we get the message out? Messaging, it's major, it's an issue. We're going to get some insight from Aaron Brownback when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, how do we bring about positive cultural change? This is wrong, this is bad, this is terrible, all these people don't agree, they're taking over this. Oh, okay, how do we bring about positive change? I have a book coming out in September called Saving a Sick America, where I lay out how sick we are, and then how by following biblical principles, including for marriage and family, but in every other area of society, that it can bring life to the nation. In other words, we're not trying to impose the Bible on the nation. We're saying if God's people would live by Scripture, it would bring about positive change, and we could then present that positive change to the nation. My guest, Aaron Brownback, is an advocate for the goodness of God's design for the family as the ideal foundation of society. This includes the topics of gender, marriage, sex life, and parenting. And she's developing a long-term messaging plan for the pro-family movement and working on a PhD in social transformation. Her website, Erin, that's E-R-I-N, erinbrownback.com. So, Erin, let's talk about this all-important issue of messaging. How have we done, in your evaluation as conservative Christians, Bible-believing Christians, how have we done in terms of getting our message out to a society that does not take for granted the things that previous generations took for granted?
You know, Dr. Brown, that's a great question. A lot of people don't even know what messaging is. They're just living their lives. They're just thinking things are happening naturally, organically around them. And they don't realize that there are people and groups that are intentionally putting messages into entertainment, into the news, into business, into education that promote the agenda that they have. As conservatives and as Christians, you know, I think we've been a little bit more on the side of innocent as doves and a little bit less on the side of wise as serpents. Mm-hmm. We haven't engaged in really getting our message out. For instance, a great example is when it comes to charitable giving. Conservatives and Christians, people of faith, outgive both dollar amount and percentage of income than anyone else. But it seems like a lot of sort of bleeding heart, emotional, loud speaking people, they must be the ones who really care about the environment and healthcare and the homeless. And really, here we are funding those things out of our own pockets. Adoption's another great example. It's the people of the church who do a large portion of adopting, but we don't go around talking about it, which I understand why we haven't. I understand why pregnancy centers have just done their daily work and volunteered and saved taxpayers millions and millions of dollars by helping women who are in need, but don't have the branding presence that a Planned Parenthood, who has 660 facilities when there's about 5,000 pregnancy centers, you know, Planned Parenthood has this major brand with a hugely funded message. But now it's time for us to come together and realize we not only have to do the work, we need to talk about the work that we're doing.
All right. And when you mentioned coming together, when Harvard-trained sociologist Kirk and Madsen put out their overhauling of Straight America and then their more full book After the Ball, the first being an article, the second being a book, they had met together with a large gathering of gay strategists and activists. And one of the strategies they agreed on, quote, this is put out in the late 80s, the goal was the conversion of the average American's emotions, mind, and will through a planned psychological attack in the form of propaganda fed to the nation via the media. So these gay activists told us what they were going to do and told us how they were going to do it, and they did it with brilliance to change the mindset of many, of multiplied tens of millions in America. So how do we come together? Who comes together? How do we get our message out? We're going to talk as practically as we can with my guest, Aaron Brownback. Again, her website, erinbrownback.com.
Send it, Lord.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, so we've got a wonderful message. The beauty of marriage, the beauty of parenting, the wonder of the next generation and shaping and molding them, God's ways being ways of life. Hey, husband and wife, faithful to each other, have a healthy physical union. They'll never get a sexually transmitted disease. Do the same thing with someone you're not married to, and you might just get a sexually transmitted disease. Isn't that interesting? When you have kids raised by a mom and dad, overwhelmingly, you'll see that their success rates in society are better, education is better, the crime involvement is lower, so on and so forth. And then you get kids raised in a broken home, and all the stats go in the opposite direction. It's somehow the way that our views are portrayed, where these bigoted Neanderthals just living in the past, unenlightened, out of progress with what's happening in society. Of course, the truth will triumph. How do we get the message out? Speaking with Erin Brownback on the front lines of these issues, her website, erinbrownback.com. Erin, you said we have to come together, get our message out. Who is we?
That is a great question. So there are lots of us who need to come together to do this. But how I ended up here, I worked in the pro-life movement for a number of years, and I saw, you know, we're really making progress. More pro-life laws were passed in 2011 alone than had been passed in the 10 years prior. We just saw yesterday the reinstatement of the Mexico City bill. And so we are making progress. But if we bring children into families that are not whole and healthy, we will still go down as a society. So I felt God leading me to work on the pro-family movement. And I met with 40 or so organizations that care about these issues. And what they said, you know, to their credit, honestly said to me was, we're so busy responding to the crisis of today, we're not looking that far down the road at the 20 mm-hmm. to 30 year plan. And it's difficult to get funders to donate to something that's that far down the road. Part of the issue is we have to think like we're in the minority. We have to think like those, when they wrote the same-sex activist plan, they didn't think they'd get the Obergefell decision the next day.
Absolutely.
They knew it'd be a long haul. So I have, what these groups have said to me is, if you have a plan, we will use it. And so I've just been working on my own with the assistance of those who come around me. People support me, whether organizationally or funding. People have just come around me in a variety of ways. I have clients that I work with on specific areas of these topics and have been working to put together this plan and then to disseminate it to what I call the allied organization. And from there, we all have to work together. There's 11 different outlets that need the messaging, from entertainment and social media and the news, the church, education, business, the area of medicine, like we were saying, how the American Psychological Association has played such a big part in this, the courts, public policy. We have got to move this message through all of these conduits, and that is going to take all of us working to push this message out.
Right. So when we are going to get this message out, obviously we have lots of means to do it. Be it traditional print, be it social media, be it internet, be it radio, TV. There's so many means. But do we first have to educate Christians? Do we first have to have a network of people that understand the issues and can get the message out? So when you look at the church in general, when you look at the younger generation in the church, how well do you think, again, this is a massive generalization in my question, but how well do we even understand our message? Before we talk about getting it out, how well do we understand it?
Yeah, I don't think it's something that those who hold these beliefs are equipped to articulate well. I put out a video yesterday on how the Women's March, when human justice and sexual liberty come head-to-head, like happens at the Women's March with them, not allowing pro-life groups to participate in the leadership and, you know, pro-life signs being torn down, people being spit on. What's happening is that when human justice comes head-to-head with sexual liberty, they, the Progressive Party chooses sexual liberty over and over and throws the prenatal child under the bus. So I put this video out and have had 100,000 views and people responding and saying, I was never able to put that into words. Thank you for giving me the words. And that's the education that you're talking about. It'll take key influencers, key social media influencers, key allied organization influencers to start disseminating this message. And then from there, the momentum and the snowball will begin down some of these other avenues.
All right, so we start to get the message out. Obviously, we have to live it out ourselves. So let's say that you could speak right now to every evangelical Christian in America, and you know somewhat of the pulse of the church and the stats and the various Gallup and Barna polls and what they tell you about things in evangelical circles. What would you tell us about getting our house in order? Where have we fallen short? Where do we need to shore things up? I've said my own opinion for many years that no fault heterosexual divorce in the church did more to destroy marriage than all gay activists combined. And if not for our errors and failings, the door would not be open to talk about the redefinition of marriage. You may share that view or not, but what would you say to the Church of America, not to condemn, obviously, but to say, okay, here's where we need to step up. Here's what we need to recapture.
You know, that's a great question. And to speak honestly, when I felt called to work on the long-term messaging of the family, I looked at myself and I said, you know, first of all, I come from a very loving but a broken family myself. And I would love to be married, but I'm not, and I don't have children. So I sort of asked, how am I in a position to do this? I felt called, and so I've continued to move forward in this area. But I'm not speaking to people who are going through some of these issues from a position of experiencing what they're experiencing. So I want to be sensitive to that and at the same time say the health and the wholeness of your family is the most important thing, the most important job that you have. It is more important than the work that you do. It's more important than having a two-income household that has the luxuries that America has come to think of as you know, critical. Having time together, listening, asking questions to your children, knowing what's going on in their lives, participating with them, and making your marriage healthy, doing everything that you can to make your marriage healthy, will enormously impact our society and not just your family.
All right. And some of the messages now that we want to get out. So we've talked about some of the strategies of gay activists in the past, just, you know, simple in the days before memes, you know, just gay is good, something like that, or love wins. Love is love. I mean, some of these are utterly meaningless. Some have a bit more substance. Hillary Clinton's gay rights are human rights. Many times Christians hear this and they don't know how to respond. Simple messages that we can begin to get out, or things on your video that you articulated for others. Give me some of the words. Give me some of the concepts that we want to start getting out.
Mm-hmm. Well, so first of all, an overall general guiding principle is our messages need to be about moving forward. You had mentioned this earlier in the program, not looking backward. I personally don't talk about traditional marriage because there's nothing about tradition that is inherently good. Arranged mm-hmm. marriages are traditional. Dowries are traditional. I talk about procreative marriage. I talk about holistic marriage. I don't talk about overturning Roe v. Wade. I talk about having abortion regulated by the state so that women who are being coerced, which is enormously shown to be true, women who are being coerced, that is being caught at a more local level. So I always try to position my messages as forward. Another thing is you know, the family is under attack. Everyone is feeling that, whether they're feeling it because their kids have to be signed up for countless extracurricular activities that are pulling the family apart in order to be able to get into college, whether they're feeling it because there's a sense that to keep up with the Joneses, they've got to have, you know, two incomes and both parents are out of the home, whether they're feeling it because their kids are getting sex education that says, you know, just experiment, don't worry about it, there's no consequences. The family is under attack. And that's something that we need to really make sure people understand and are messaging well.
All right, tell you what, get a couple more minutes with Erin Brown back. And I want to talk about a recent abortion article, get her take on that as well. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Erin Brown back to find out what she's doing, check out her resources, glean from what she's learned and is putting forth for the body. Go to Erin, that's E-R-I-N, erinbrownback.com. Erin, in the few minutes we have left, we may look as believers at the media, the overwhelming power of the media, and the messaging of the secular world gets out in so many ways. It may just be in a subtle way, the characters you really like in a sitcom or in some drama, that they live together or have kids out of wedlock, or talking points of gay activism just weaved into various dramas or sitcoms and not even put forth intentionally. We can sometimes feel, man, we're outmanned, outgunned, and how can we change hearts and minds? Obviously, we can pray, we can ask God to work supernaturally, but do we have to find an alternative to the secular media, which so aggressively pushes a different message? Can we win the messaging war without affecting that aspect of society?
I don't think we need to find an alternative. I think we need to engage. There are many Christians and conservatives who have built good relationships in the media industry. There are many people in media who care about the issues we care about. Jack Nicholson was raised by his grandparents thinking that his mother was his sister. The actor from The West Wing who played the president, his wife was conceived in rape. There's many people who care about our issues. Kelsey Grammer marched in the March for Life recently. We need to mobilize these people to see there is a movement behind these messages. We also need to monetize our message. That's something that the other side has been very wise and effective at doing, finding ways to tie money and message together. You think of those who promote abortion and how they make money every time a child is aborted. We need to motivate people and companies that make money when children are born to be carriers of our message. So there's a lot of ways that we can tie money to our message that we just haven't so far and that we have a huge opportunity to do.
And if folks go to your website, will they get some ideas or some food for thought in this way?
Yes, absolutely. You can go to my website. You can sign up and give me your email. I'll be sending out messaging every few weeks. You can follow me on Facebook or Twitter. And I've even got a children's book that's got a strong pro-life message, but in a very subtle way coming out. And you can see that on my website as well.
Neat. Again, that's erinbrownback.com. Erin, I wrote an article last night called When Pro-Abortion Sentiments Trump Science and Common Sense, and said the harder the left works to deny the humanity of the unborn child, the more it exposes its moral and scientific bankruptcy. And I was responding to what others have called a bizarre and rambling article on The Atlantic by a woman who was arguing that fetal heartbeat really means nothing and that ultrasounds can be used deceptively and that the whole pro-life movement is largely male patriarchy. One article mocking it on the Federalist used the title Abortion Science, Heartbeats Are Imaginary, Unborn Babies Aren't Alive, and Ultrasounds Are Just Tools of the Patriarchy. You say when it comes to abortion that we are we are getting our message out better and that more hearts are being changed. Sentiments have changed since Roe v. Wade till today. Of course, the horror of abortion remains through these decades. But how is it that we have been more successful there in getting our message out?
Yeah, so I read your article, and it's great, and you're absolutely right. Nobody who is medically relevant anymore is saying this isn't a life. That's a really extreme position that people aren't taking. Instead, people are recognizing the humanity of the prenatal child, which is a message that we have been carrying and we need to continue to carry. The pro-life position has been, that messaging battle has been waged for the last, in a more coordinated way, for the last 20 or so years, very roughly. I did national research on the public perception of Planned Parenthood, and we realized that if we can expose that this is a money-making entity, people's hearts will change. And that's what we've been doing. We've been showing this is tied to money, and people don't like it. So we've had a good long amount of time that we have been addressing that issue. On the flip side, we've been very lulled into complacency or unawareness that the breakdown of marriage and of gender has been taking place over the last few decades. So we're behind the eight ball, and we've got a road to go. We've got a generation. We've got a couple of decades. But it is a path that we can follow and that we can come out on the other side with a nation whose hearts and minds see every child wants a mother and a father. People want to be a part of a whole family, and societies thrive when families are whole.
Yeah, well said, and encouraging words as well. When I wrote the book Outlasting the Gay Revolution, which came out in 2015, a lot of it was still waking people up to what was happening in the society and saying, hey, we're not talking about the future. These things have already happened. And for the most part, Americans wanted to be tolerant and accepting, but they didn't expect a lot of the baggage that came along with this. And part of the way I said that we would outlast the gay revolution was by doing the very things you're talking about, by having solid families. And then in my book, Saving a Sick America, I lay this out in more depth in terms of God's ways being ways of life. And really, that's our greatest message, that this is the way God intended the human race to be. And when we do it his way, there is blessing. And therefore, our message is a message of life and hope and salvation and freedom. And to the extent we get that out, as people see other means and systems failing, then our way of life is attractive and something that will reproduce in a good way. So, Aaron, appreciate what you're doing. What's your timetable, you think, in finishing your PhD?
Oh, I'm just working on it slowly. Like I said, I'm working full-time on my own. I'd love to come under the right organization to do this work. But for right now, I consult with groups, and I speak, and I work on my own as I slowly am working through my coursework. So we'll see how that all plays out over the next few years.
Yeah, and the nice thing is during this time, you can really pray and keep crying out, our God, where is this supposed to fit? How is this supposed to be? Because a lot of times we try to figure out, it doesn't work. But I'd love to see when you get to defend your doctoral thesis.
Thank you.
And look, there's something, I mean, that's almost prophetically what you're living out in microcosm there, that you're going to live out at the university what you're seeking to do on the outside. And perhaps hearts and minds will change along the way. So great to speak with you. I'm sure in many ways we'll partner together in the coming days, and may God's blessing be on your work and your studies.
Thanks so much for having me. I so admire your work.
Well, appreciate it. God bless you. All right, erinbrownback.com. That is E-R-I, and looking at the website as we speak. All right, friends, that was my ring, my wedding ring, my wonderful wedding ring, hitting the mic there. But hey, that's appropriate. After talking about marriage and family, go to thelineoffire.org. We've put together at a great, great price, a great resource to start your new year in the right direction. Check it out along with all the great resources on our digital library. My bottom line, God's ways are ways of life, and they will last forever.